Awesome. Angela, glad to finally have you on the podcast. I know we had talked once prior to this on a call. I think we just had connected on Twitter. And well, it was Twitter at the time. Now it's X. So it feels like a long time ago. But how you doing today?
I'm doing well, and I think that intro statement just tells us how we measure time now. Is it pre-pandemic? Is it pre-Elon Musk Twitter? Like, what is the time frame here?
Right? It's crazy. It's crazy. Yeah, you have a lot of stuff going on your end, and I was really pumped when you reached out that you were interested in coming on the podcast. You got a lot of content and media related stuff that you work on. You have your own podcast. So tell me a little bit more about Rootful Media and what you're building over there. It sounds really, really awesome.
Yeah, so I think maybe sometime last year, I think is when I started to realize, like, okay, I've gotten really good at, client work, at freelance work, and that's all well and great. But in 2022, I just worked like crazy, and I was just like, this just isn't sustainable. Like, my skills can grow and my client list can grow, but ultimately I'm just one person and I want to build something that is greater than me and that allows me to not work all the time, and still allows me to create work that I'm proud of. And so I really started thinking deeply about diversifying my income streams and diving into leveraging the online audience that I've built to create other things. So I already had Honey and Hustle, which is my podcast. And I had already invested in editors for that. But then towards the end of last year, I also added the newsletter component. And I've since recommitted to posting on YouTube regularly again outside of the podcast. So really, it's just about building my personal, I guess, personal brand, but really an extension of Rootful Media because Honey and Hustle is an extension of Rootful Media. And that's kind of the nuts and bolts of what the empire looks like right now.
That's awesome. That's awesome. What do you enjoy doing the most? Which one of those things do you enjoy doing the most? And then the second layer to that question is maybe you want to answer this first, is what is the meaning behind Honey and Hustle? Was that wh How did you come up with that name?
Okay, I'll answer that one first. That's always a fun
Okay.
question. So, Honey and Hustle, I saw this graphic, and I get really inspired by graphic design a lot. I'm a sucker for good design, clean design. And I saw this graphic that was like this big H, and I had Hustle on the top and Humble on the bottom. And I said, how can I flip that to make it more feminine and more badass, and more representative of like maybe my approach to business, which is something that's a little more relationship based. And definitely is not like hustle till you die based. So that's kind of how Honey and Hustle came to be. It was a good alliteration, but also kind of indicative of what we're trying to create there. So.
That's awesome. That's really awesome. I'm a sucker for design too, and when I see something that's just very clever and creative, I always go into that same mindset where I'm just like, "Huh, that was really clever. How do I spin that into something of my own?" So that's really refreshing to hear, because I don't hear many people. There's always this like crazy reason, like there was this name and this, and it's like, no, sometimes it's just the design catches your eye and you're just like, "I need that in my life somehow in some similar shape or form." So that's really, really cool. How long have you been doing the podcast? And tell me a little bit more about that. Like, who do you talk to? What is the I guess for you, what do you get out of the podcast for yourself? Because I think that's always the most important part.
For me, actually, it wasn't the most important part when I started. I started it in March 2020, so it was a pandemic podcast. And I started it really just to like connect with people in my community who are full-time entrepreneurs or creators or creative entrepreneurs, because I was like, I know I want to go full-time one day. These people have already done it. What can I learn from them? And not only what can I learn, but what about people who don't have access to just reach out to these people and talk to them and ask them questions? Like, how can I make these conversations accessible? And I think that once I did go full time in May of 2020, so like 2 months after I started this, I think it became all the more relevant because now I was like experiencing full-time creative entrepreneurship and I knew what questions to ask because I knew what I was going through and the things that I wanted to know. I was like, this is what I'm trying to work through, you know, outsourcing and hiring and trying to decide what tools I needed in my business to help me work more efficiently and, you know, how to balance, you know, the things I wanted to do and achieve creatively with also like making money, you know? So all these things, they really, I think, have lent to the success of the show because it's not like I'm just some person on the outside who's curious. It's like, no, I'm a part of this community of people that I'm interviewing. And I think it adds to my credibility because they know that I'm a business owner as well. And they're more willing to talk with me than someone who's just trying to pick their brain for 30 minutes to an hour, you know?
And they probably also feel a sense of like, this person may actually put in some of this information into use rather than just collect, and then not do anything with it. So a thought came to mind. It's like you can have all these same questions literally for the same questions for different people, and you get completely different responses of how they kind of got there and what they're doing. So that's always a really interesting approach, and that's. That's sort of what this, you know, when I started this podcast, it was always this, the reason why I named it What Is My Brain is because I always just figured that everybody's brain has this sense of like, at least comes from me, it's like these thoughts sometimes come about or how you hear things and how you flip them in your head. And it's like my go-to was always like everyone's brain works differently. Like, what is your brain compared to my brain compared to the next person? And it's like, it's all different. Like there's so many different, you know, extensions and components and different things. So that's really cool to hear that you did it for the sake of, you know, wanting to expand what you're doing, but also connecting with the right people and building sort of that network. So that's really awesome. And how many episodes do you have total at the moment?
We crossed 100 episodes on the last season. So I think we're at like 101. Wow. We've already recorded 26 episodes for season 4, and that those start getting released next week. So
wow, that's amazing. And you said you have a team behind you that's doing a lot of the editing and stuff like that?
Yeah, so I've edited a few episodes, but mostly my team is editing it. Two editors that I'm working with here in person, in Durham and Raleigh, and then I have one remote editor that does my remote interviews. And then we added a writer, a part-time writer to the team. So I'm still doing a lot of the show running, the creative direction. And to answer your question from earlier, that's my favorite part of the show. I like the ideation. I like the writing and scripting and thinking about packaging. That to me is the fun part, you know? So
I love it. What do you enjoy more, the podcast or the newsletter, or are there other components of the media company that you're building that you enjoy more? Or is it just like certain days are for certain things kind of thing?
I mean, like I'm diving into creating original film projects as well. Oh, so wow. That's always fun. And I would say there isn't one part that I like more than the other, but I will say that there are certain parts that have been more like, at least front end successful than others, which is really interesting to see. Mm-hmm. So like the newsletter, we started it in November from scratch, and it's already at over 100 subscribers, and I haven't had to pay a dime. I just have had to like put it out there, you know? So like, I feel like it grew a lot faster than my YouTube channel, for example. Right. But yeah, a lot of the ideas from the newsletter come from YouTube and the podcast. Right. So always interesting to see. Like I've heard other people say this too, like you're, next thing is always more successful than the one before it. And it's not because it's necessarily better, but it's because you're bringing the experience from the previous project to it. Right. So like the podcast kind of, when I put it on streaming, it took off a little bit faster than the video side, even though I had video up first. And still to this day, the video is higher, but I think that's again, because I just put it out there first before I put it on streaming. And then like after the podcast, now the newsletter is like taking off, and I feel like the newsletter is going to grow a lot faster than the previous two, just because like you're bringing all that experience and knowledge from the previous two ventures into this new thing. So that's always interesting. It like, so on some level, it breaks your heart. It's like, have I been terrible this whole time? Or is it just now that like it's like compiled, you know, experience that's working in my favor. So I don't know.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. And I always look at it. Sometimes I feel like you catch even on, you know, like Netflix or any of these streaming services or even like podcasts, you'll hear one episode that's like, you know, it's like 30 episodes in, and then you get stuck to it and you're like, wait, what else did this person do? And you just go back and do look at kind of, I do that with music a lot where I hear a song somewhere and I'm at a show and I'm like, that is the greatest song ever. What else have these people created? And then you go back and you listen to all their old stuff. You look at all their YouTube things, you look at all of that. And then it kind of brings everything full force into like, oh, this is really cool. Actually, I did that with a few artists and a few creators that I've kind of tapped into their podcasts out of nowhere. I'm like, oh, this is actually like kind of interesting. I wonder what else they did. And it kind of takes you down this like rabbit hole in a way. So that's always really, really fun. And I look at it, I don't know, maybe you agree or disagree, but like there's the writing component, there's the video, the YouTube side of things, and then there's the audio, which is like the podcast and stuff. And I always feel like, I know for myself, there's certain days where I prefer reading something, there's certain days I prefer just listening to something, and there's some days where I just want to pop open my iPad and go on YouTube and just like watch a video of two people talking. It's really weird. And I feel like nowadays, if you, not saying that the whole thing, the reason why we create is to go viral, but it's like, if you want to make any kind of impact or you want to touch people, you really do have to be on all platforms as much as possible. I know that's really tough, especially, I mean, you have a little bit more of a team, and I'm sure that, you know, there's strategy to get on certain platforms and different things, but I do really feel like you're cutting yourself a little bit short if you're not trying to at least post some stuff across different things, because I've had stuff on TikTok that went, you know, 1,000, 2,000 views. And then I see people coming to follow me on Twitter. And then I see the engagement on the podcast go up, and these numbers just start to kind of like fluctuate in different ways. So that's always really, really interesting. Like, do you kind of see that with some, I mean, I know the newsletter now is kind of starting to take off a little bit, but like, do you see any of the social media side of things really like influencing more of the YouTube or vice versa? Like where people find you on YouTube and then all of a sudden they're just like, hey, saw your thing on YouTube, and now they're following you, I don't know, on like Twitter and different things like that.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting you say that. Like, I feel like Colin and Samir had that ecosystem where sometimes it's like, I just want to read the newsletter. Sometimes I'm like in the car and I want to hear, or I'm taking a walk and I want to just listen to their podcast. But then like, you know, early in the morning, I'm like, it's early. I just want my YouTube. I want my news. I just want to turn this on while I'm cooking and eating breakfast and things. So it's like different times of day, you want different things. And I think for me, you know, when I started the podcast, doing all this, you know, like I said, it was just video, like straight up just video when I first started for the first like 20 episodes. And I think that works for me. And I think I'm glad that I wasn't aware of like different ecosystems, like building that early on, because I think it is kind of like too much, especially when you don't have the time or money or help to invest in making something really good. And I think the trap that people fall into with podcasting, especially because it's seen as like the holy grail of repurposing, right? It's like, that's what everybody tells you. Make a video podcast, you can make anything else from this. And that's true. But I think sometimes what people repurpose from their video podcast is absolute fucking trash. And it just needs to stay where it is. Like, I would prefer you make one really great thing than try to make 10 really terrible or mediocre things just for the sake of making them, you know? And so that's where I lean. I'm definitely like a quality first type. And then quantity can come from that once you understand how to repackage things for different platforms. So like what you were saying, like one thing that really helped my YouTube was like having that little auto plug under. It's like, hey, if you like tweets like this, you'd love my YouTube channel. And I saw a lot of like traffic coming from that. I would say it's a more rare, and it's happened, but I can count on one hand how many times someone has followed me on Twitter from YouTube. Typically, if people find me on YouTube and they like me, they would just want to stay on YouTube. You know, they want that type of content. They really don't care about like what I ate for breakfast, you know? So I think it's just like, again, it's also just like understanding what people want out of different platforms. And like having being on multiple platforms really is for like your super fans. The people who are following you on multiple channels are like people who really rock with you, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah, no, it makes all a lot of sense. And I also feel like I love that concept of consuming, like when you're eating breakfast, you're consuming more of a video because you're like, I don't want to be reading and looking over at my, like I could kind of be doing two things at one time. I think there's something to that. And I feel like if people could tap into that a little bit more and making the content just as tight as it needs to be for those moments, like your little like extra breakfast snack in terms of like a video, like that can have some cool expansion to it. Take me back a little bit in terms of how you got into the space of what you're doing. And I know you said you also do a lot of freelance work and different things like that. What were your kind of your beginnings? Were you always kind of in the creative space? Did you have a regular job and you just hated it? Like what's your kind of story from the beginning? I'd love to hear a little bit more about that because you're doing a lot of cool shit now. And I know it's not like, it probably hasn't always been like that.
Definitely not. Not to take it back too far, but like when I picked up a camera, I was in college, right? So I was fairly young. You know, I wasn't thinking about making it a career. It wasn't until I graduated with my bachelor's that I was like, yeah, maybe I don't want to be in school forever. Like maybe that's not the life for me. Like maybe I want to do something a little more on the creative side. If I could make it sustainable, because that was still a question mark largely, I feel like around, this was 2016. And, you know, I kept going down that route. I had started my business, at least online. I started a Facebook page, which was what everybody did then, you know, like I have a business starting a Facebook page, you know, like this was Instagram hadn't even really like taken off as a place to put your photography out there yet. Not truly.
Right.
I started a Facebook page. I was serious, you know, and I was posting and stuff. Then I finished my graduate degree and I was like, okay, like I'm still doing this photography thing. And I've added a little bit of video. So like the investment into doing great video is more than what I could reasonably invest as a hobbyist. Like I do need to maybe be more serious about learning the business side of things, which I hadn't done up until that point. And so once I started learning the business side of things, that was 2018. I went full time in May of 2020. So about a year and a half, really, of just really committing to learning that and networking my ass off and meeting a bunch of people and just putting myself out there and being willing to learn is about my time frame. And I did have a job for about a year after my grad degree, from May 2019 to May 2020. And I wouldn't say I hated the job or I hated the work. It just wasn't the environment for me. Sitting in a cubicle 8 hours a day where people are having meetings all around me and I'm in a stiff ass suit and I'm the youngest person on my team and they find it very strange that I have a life outside of work. Like this just wasn't that, it just wasn't work. you know, it's like, dude, I'm like, I was like 25, 26. Like it, I was just like, you gotta be kidding me. You want me to give my life to this job? Like that as a concept is just not working out for me.
Right.
And then too, you know, once the pandemic hit and I was home, it's like, yes, like a slower life is, this is what I want. Right. Like not waking up in the morning. The first thing I do is like, I'm sitting in the car for 30 minutes thinking only about my job.
Right.
And then I go home, drive another 30 minutes, and I'm still thinking about my job. And maybe I have time to eat or go to a networking event and then like talk to my mom on the phone, go to sleep, and I do it all over again. Like that just is not the life that I want. Like I, you know, or thinking about my vacation days a year in advance because I only have so many. Like that's just not it. You know, like I felt like there was something better for me out there. And I felt like I could take a chance on myself when I did. And I did. I took a little bit of a pay cut, but I had some like savings saved up. And that's how I got full time. And I will say that, you know, the podcast started, you know, very rough. It wasn't anywhere near as polished as it is now. But, you know, it was me putting myself out there, you know, and sometimes you just got to be willing to be terrible in public and grow from there. And I think that's like okay to say and okay to do. But not a lot of people are comfortable. But if I hadn't done that, I wouldn't have YouTube channel videos and podcast episodes and a newsletter and, you know, a body of work that I could show to pitch for original film work. Like I wouldn't have any of those things.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. That's a really, really, really cool story. And the thing that I get out of that, as you were talking, and I'm kind of just like, my thoughts tend to just like float away really quickly sometimes. So just even like one word, but like, where does your awareness come from? Like you're very well aware of even just being in that job and realizing like certain things about not wanting to be there and consuming. I mean, to the point where you're talking about, you know, 30-minute drive, all I'm thinking about is my job, 30 minutes back, all I'm thinking about is my job. Like, where's that awareness come from? Is that something that was always within you? Or did you just notice that because you hated your job so much or didn't want to be there? And you're just like, I can't do this anymore. Like, where does that come from?
Yeah, some of it did come from my discontent with the job. Some of it came from therapy and my therapist being like, you know, you've mentioned this a couple of times now. Like, let's talk about it. You know, and for people who don't like the word therapy, just say business coach. They're a therapist that you pay more money. Yeah. Same thing.
That's luxury right there.
Exactly. You know, just pay more money. They don't accept insurance. It's the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, yeah, some of it was that. And, you know, I had been doing some hard thinking, you know, like I said, way before I ever went full time. You know, it was, you know, I think going full time as a creator, making a life from creativity is not something that just happens by accident. You know, really does require a level of intentionality to do it in a way that allows you to have freedom if that's what you want, which is what I wanted on some level, the freedom to create more and make a life from that, and also freedom from things I didn't want, right? Like a commute to work.
Right.
So I do think it takes a level of intentionality. And for me, that intentionality was not just, I want to get out of this job. It's that I want to have a business, if you will, that actually gives me the things that I do want, you know? So there's definitely multiple layers there.
I like that. And now follow up to that. What is your personal definition of like success? Is success to you monetary, or is success to you more like freedom and time?
Oh man.
Or is it just being able to be creative? Is that just like the baseline is like, if I can be creative, that feels like success and everything else comes after that.
I think there's a couple different levels. From a monetary aspect, being able to afford to create in the way that I want and live the life that I want, I think that's a measure of success to me. And we'll talk about maybe specific metrics of success. I think that goalpost can grow and evolve and change as you grow and evolve and change. But ultimately, like, that's the thing. And I think my first little hint that I was on the way there was I went to get groceries one time. And like, I didn't realize until I got back to the car that I didn't check the price on anything. I was just throwing shit in the cart and like swiping, didn't have to check my bank account, didn't think about it. I was like, the budget has
increased. Felt fucking good. That felt fucking good, right?
The budget is feeling great right now. You know what I mean? When you don't have to check, that's when you know the budget is great. There's nothing I can buy that's
I love that comparison, by the way, because that's how I love shopping. Like, my grocery store to me is Disneyland. I love food. I'm a foodie. When I go in, I want to buy just like the best things that I possibly can because I really enjoy it. And what you just said there, that is definitely one of those definitions of success, is being able to walk in and be like, I'm fucking buying whatever I want, and I'm not even checking the price. I'm going in, swiping my card, and walking out of there. I don't even want the receipt. Like, don't even give me the receipt.
Tell me I saved $2.03 today. It's not changing much, but yeah, you know.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Hell
yeah. So that was, to me, a measure of success. I was like, this is great. Like, this is amazing. And then when it comes to time freedom, it was also just like, when I first moved here for the first couple of years, this would be 5 years in North Carolina for me. I was only going home like once a year. Now,
where are you originally from? Just out of curiosity, where are you? Alabama. Like, where's home? Alabama. Okay. Okay. Cool.
Yeah. So I was only going home once a year, and that was like my vacation, quote unquote, was going home. Mm-hmm. Now it's like I travel all the time. I go home more than one time a year. You know, I can afford to host my family, not even afford, but I can host my family up here if they want to come up, you know, like, we also go on a separate vacation every year. So like, there's, you know, like that freedom, and I don't have to check with anybody. I don't have to say like, are we going to get off? you know, this week of things. Like, no, I booked the flight. I'm going home. If anybody needs me, don't. That's how that goes, you know, like, and that's a great feeling. Like, I don't have to check with somebody to do basic things like spend time with my family. Like, that's just, you know, a great feeling. And then creatively, I feel like in today's age, it could be said that there's a lot of enviable outcomes, what Justin Welch calls shiny outcome syndrome. Like, you want what other people have as a result of their work. I think for me, it's always been very simple, and that's to create things that only I can create. And as long as I'm doing that, I think whatever comes from it is great. You know, if I get into Sundance one day, incredible. If I get a movie that goes to theaters, awesome. If I sell a show to Hulu, great. But ultimately, like, I really just want to create something that I can only create, that's special, that's done at the level and the quality and the trueness that it deserves and the fullness that it deserves. And whatever comes from that comes from that. Obviously, I want the most eyeballs on it as possible. Let's not downplay this. I'm not that humble.
Right.
But, you know, but, you know, ultimately, like, you know, I'm also just like, there's a part of me that loves that there can be this open-ended situation now, right? Like, as you know, there's only so much that I can control. And, you know, I do have goals and things that I want to accomplish. But ultimately, like, it all starts from the root, which is that I had the time, the money, the finances, the team to create the things that I love to create. So
I love it. I love it. That's really, really inspiring to hear, because it's not just one definition. It's not just money. It's not just this. It's like a little bit of everything, and just the simple things about even the grocery store, that to me is stands out as the best piece of it, if I'm being very honest. And obviously the family stuff, it's like it's a non-negotiable for me to be able to go see my family when I want to go see them and travel and do all those things. So that's really, really awesome. Tell me a little bit more about the film stuff. Like, what's your involvement there? Like, what are you doing? Are you doing a lot of the script writing? Are you doing the directing? Like, do you have a team that you're working on? Are you working on any like projects right now that you're trying to submit to certain places? Tell me a little bit more about that.
Oh, yes. Happy to. So my first film was a solo film. I directed it. I did all the research for it. I edited it, and I did the marketing and outreach and stuff, which included an indie film screening, which is my first film screening for anything, which is awesome. I almost shit my pants. I was so nervous, but it was great.
Congratulations.
But it's like, I'm glad that I did the first one myself, from like idea to finished product and delivery, because I kind of learned a lot through that process. And looking back on it, there's, you know, 1,000 things I would do differently. I would use a different camera. I would, you know, yada, yada, yada. But the reality is, I think it was a great proof of concept of what I could create, and kind of showed me a little bit about my style, I think, and my voice as a creator. And right now I'm working on a docuseries on water contamination in Eastern North Carolina. And we're hoping, it's in post-production now. I'm working with an editor on that, and I've worked with a cam op, I've worked with an audio guy. So a 4-person team, as opposed to, like, you know, a 1-person team. So slightly bigger team, super happy with how that's going. And we're hoping to have like at least a teaser or something that can help us fund the rest of the docuseries, which, and give it the treatment and love that it deserves. Because the first one, I was working as a part-time contractor with an organization, and they really essentially were like paying me to work on this film over the course of several months. So I didn't really have to worry about pitching for funding, and I also received a micro grant as part of a storytelling fellowship. So I had funding like to make the film. That was never an issue. Now it's like, when you're doing something indie, that's like everybody's biggest thing. It's like, how do you get indie projects, you know, funded? And like, I'm going through that right now. We've gotten some grants already, but just with the time commitment and the crew, it's like, yeah, we need to get a nice working like teaser going, so we can have something to show, because I think that's ultimately what is going to get us more money.
I love it. Let me tap into that really quickly. How does funding for a movie truly work? Is it just like an existing network of people that you already know, or is there some sort of I mean, you know, in the startup world, it's like VCs. Like, is there some sort of VC type of structure within that world where, you know, you're not selling to maybe the Hulus and the Netflix, but you're maybe more in the, you know, like you said, the indie stuff where it gets like on a YouTube, paid YouTube channel or something like that?
Yeah, so I would say, like, from my understanding and experience, there's about three ways you can go about getting an indie film or indie project funded. One is crowdfunding. That's probably the fastest, but again, depends on you having an audience of people who can raise a substantial amount of money in 30 to 90 days, essentially. And that is, I would say, for creators who already have big audiences, like your Dani Gavirts, people like that could, big YouTubers, that could probably work extremely well to get something off the ground at a bare minimum. And he also had the support of like Maddie Hopoya, who executive produced it. So he probably put a sizable chunk of money into seeing that film get created. That's one way. I would say that's probably maybe like 10% of people would be successful, like truly successful crowdfunding doing that. The way that you mentioned, like the VC way. So there are people who invest in films, and those typically are they get an ROI by that film being sold. So for example, a friend of mine, he got an investor, some Norwegian guy, and he ended up selling and licensing his film to Red Bull for like 3 years. So he was able to pay his investor back. So those are those type of situations. So those you kind of do have to go in mind with like this is something that I could sell to a potential company. The third one, which is what I'm doing and what I imagine most people do, is grant funding. So grant writing is a lot slower, and film pitching. So there are organizations where you can pitch films to, which is again almost VC-like, but it does start with more of an application process versus like a one-to-one. Like it's much harder to get in, like unless you just know an exec at Hulu, for example, then yes, by all means, ask them for money. But like if not, and you're like everybody else, you probably have to go through a network or an organization that has film competitions or a film festival that has pitch competitions where you can get in front of, the A24s and the production team behind the A24s and stuff like that. So that's what we're in the process of doing now. We've gotten two grants so far, and we're submitting for some pitch competitions and some grants as well this year. So, but I think ultimately from what I've heard from people who have been successful is like you need some kind of working teaser to have proof of concept.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I'd actually be very interested. I just wrote down some thoughts. Like, I'd be very interested to see how if you guys got it done and got the full you know full movie completed, to simply I don't know, somehow reach out to the team at X and see if like you can have some sort of feature on there so that like people can watch it literally, because Elon's all about putting long form video on there now and using that sort of concept to see like how that would work out. Because I feel like there would be some sort of, especially if it's, you know, something that they would enjoy as well, that it's a good movie and all these other things. Like I would definitely like explore that if that's an option for you guys, to see if just like posting it up there and having some sort of, you know, I don't know, some sort of way of getting it out, getting the views, getting some maybe money out of like the revenue share that they're doing a lot now and things like that. So that was just one thought that came to mind, because it is still pretty, the platform in terms of the video side is still pretty fresh, and I feel like there's still a lot of opportunity for people to maximize on that.
Yeah, one thing I'll say about that, just as like a slight pushback. So, and not like this is a bad idea, but just in like, I know that if you're asking, there's other people of asking, and I've also had this thought too of just like when people say, well, what's your film distribution plan? It's like, well, put it up on social. And it's like, okay, there's some caveats there, right? So,
I would
social.
imagine there would be, yeah.
Yeah. So when I think of like, how do we get the eyes, not just the most eyes on the film, but like the right eyes on the film. A lot of that does come back to like, how are we targeting certain populations, right? So for, especially for docufilm work, something that's not a YouTube, not a podcast, right? So something that's very specific, just like any other film or movie. It is like indie film screenings, number one, are always going to be like one of your best bets. Whether that's a film festival circuit or an actual like in-person film screening that you set up. because you can, you know, control the organizations that you work with to partner on it and promote it. You can control the location. So if you want it in a bigger city or a rural area, depending on the audience or the type of film, you have that accessibility as well. Or student films, you know, like if you want to do it on a campus, like reach that audience of people, like that's more of an option. And when you're doing independent films, if you're, especially if you're trying to do them in a way that people will pay to see, and a reason why film festivals require that you submit things that haven't been seen is because it feels more exclusive if nobody's seen it yet.
Yeah.
So if I were to put this whole film on Twitter and then try to submit it to a film festival, they would not see the reason to put it in front of their audience because anybody can go online, right? Like it cheapens the experience of going to see exclusive work, you know, getting a peek at indie films that nobody else has seen yet, you know, and like, again, people are paying hundreds of dollars for tickets at film festivals, right? Like they're not going to pay for something they can see for free on the internet. So typically, like if you look at, I think it's, can't remember if it's like Yes Theory, but one of those big YouTuber collective channels like that, where they did a film and they put it through a film festival circuit and then they put it on YouTube. And the reason they did that too, that helped them be so successful on the YouTube release, was because like it had gotten a lot of chatter about how good it was at the film festival. So it's almost like these indirect testimonials that maybe you, like, let's say if you're watching a big film and you're seeing like all these film critics that have already put out quotes and reviews on it, that's kind of what film festivals are for indie films. It's like you can get, you know, this feedback already that like drives up hype for the movie before it's put out into mainstream. So again, like people always talk about like proof of concept and like, you know, testimonials being really big driving forces for people's like inclination to pay for something or, you know, watch something, whatever it is. That's kind of just the same thing here. It's like social media, and I would put YouTube in this, but not that YouTube is necessarily social, but like YouTube, Twitter, even Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, maybe Threads, maybe, I don't know. Like those are easy ways to get it in front of eyeballs, but not maybe the most lucrative eyeballs.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense. I was also just kind of came to mind like the whole concept of having it up there and for it to be like free. Like you can even potentially test like a 7-day thing where you put it up there. Don't let anyone download the video because you can kind of restrict that now. And then just put it up there for like 3 to 5 to 7 days. See what the response is, collect some of that data, and then all of a sudden just take it down and then go out and maybe use that as like a little bit of a, because people will comment on it. You can, like you said, you can kind of use that as like maybe a little bit of vanity metrics, but just to be like, hey, look, this is how many views we got. We got a lot of people commenting on it and all these other things, like, and just kind of maybe, I don't know, something along the lines. It's actually kind of, from a marketing perspective, that could be really, really fun to test different waters of what, like, what can work and what doesn't. And that's really, really awesome. And that's, when do you guys plan on sort of having that, you know, roll out slowly or have the teaser and all that stuff done?
Yeah, so we're hoping to have something by the end of February for sure.
Oh, wow.
And I think too, just to your point in terms of like testing, like I think you were the one that posted that like you were going to test dropping a whole podcast season at once.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really interesting concept because like Netflix does it all the time. They'll just drop a whole season, right? So it's just like, you know, I was like, I thought about that too because I have so many episodes recorded. I was like, what if I just dropped them all like...
Yep.
How would that work? Would YouTube hate me? Like, what would happen?
Right? Yeah. Like, right.
And then the opposite, too, is like, you know, when we think about marketing experiments, I also think about packaging and how that kind of tends to be a lost art, especially if you're coming from like the freelance world, like we kind of are, like where you're just making probably one video or one short film or whatever it is for a client. You're not necessarily thinking about a rollout. And I think that's something I'm thinking about now, like as I've been doing for the podcast and I'm thinking about this show, it's like, okay, even if we do a teaser per each episode in the docuseries, right? Like what about having a free scene? So instead of posting the whole thing on Twitter and seeing that review, like maybe just posting like a scene from that and seeing like, how does that, you know, are people liking it? How are they responding to it? Is it sparking curiosity? You know, like what's
a good cliffhanger? A good cliffhanger on the in the show. Yeah.
So like kind of seeing like how does that work? You know what I mean? Like so not just a tease of like this is what it's all about, but just like one little scene that's just like this is a taste of what this is about? Do you like it? Are people like wanting to watch more? Do they care about this? You know, what are some of the things they're saying? And then I've also seen people do just like director's cuts of them. Like, so I think there was one, it wasn't Origin. It was another movie that Ava DuVernay worked on with Oprah. And before the movie, she put out like just like a little cut, like a director's cut of her working with Oprah, like as an actor, and showing that like director actor relationship. And I'm like, okay, like what are some other elements that we can tease out here?
Yeah.
And then the fourth thing too, I guess I'm just giving away all my gems, but like that's what this is my mind. So like, I'm also thinking like the podcast space, there's this podcast called the Micro Budget Film Podcast, I think. So it's looking at how to, you know, showing people how to create films on like a micro budget. A micro budget can be anything under $5 million.
Right.
So fairly wide range here. You know, it can be anything from like, you know, something you just do for free to like 10,000 to like 1 million, anything. And it was like a intentionally a limited series podcast, but there's also this concept of like, what if we did, you know, if maybe, especially if you're a smaller creator and maybe you're not going to get, you know, the type of press run that a bigger film would get, like do your own press run via a podcast. And like, it's, you know, different interviews or just conversations with like the actors, the crew, the director, the producers, maybe even some people that help fund it, like the organizations, what they're most excited about, like, you know, creating your own press run through a podcast. And then of course, repurposing that strategically to see, you know, what's resonating with people, you know, what do they kind of want to see? How do they want to see the film? You know, are they excited to see it at an upcoming film festival? That sort of thing. Like, I think
I love that.
Know, in terms of just thinking about how we market things, I think we have the space to be innovative now when it comes to film.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think a mixture between, you know, if you don't get enough of the funding that you actually need, a mixture between like a good podcast tour of, you know, setting up 10 to 20 to 30 podcast episodes that you can get on different people's podcasts, you know, specifically, you know, talking about the movie. And it might not even have to be like an hour long podcast. It could be a 15, 20 minute conversation, just simply like taking clips from that, putting it all together, maybe sharing different information across different podcasts. And so that way, when you like put it all together, you can kind of have this, you know, compilation type of thing. So yeah, there's a lot of different creative ways of approaching that. And I feel like that might spark some of that interest for people to be like, okay, what the hell is this about? Now I really need to, you know, because I always, it's always the hardest thing, but I always put myself get sparked by something and it sparks my curiosity, I always kind of go in the opposite direction. I was like, what can I do to do that same thing to myself? And that's always the hardest thing to do, right? It's like, you don't know till you actually get hit with something. You're like, oh wow, that was really clever. Like what got me there? And you kind of have to roll that back a little bit. So that's always really interesting. I think podcasts for me, in all honesty now, especially with like video going on Spotify and different things like that, there's a lot of potential there that still I think is untapped. And I know I asked you earlier how many episodes, and you said like over 100, and you have like 20 something like sitting in the chamber at the moment. You know, the stat is pretty crazy. I think like only 10% of podcasts make it past like episode 12, and it's like everybody else kind of drops off before that. It's really amazing to me. And I feel like the monetization outside of the, you know, the Rogans and all some of these other people that have these big sponsors like the Athletic Greens or whatever that might be, I do still believe that's a very untapped market. And that, and I think newsletter sponsorships for specific projects and specific like niches, like where you kind of have somebody that has maybe 5,000 subscribers, but they're really deep in that game or wherever your audience you think might be. I think there's a lot of opportunity there to kind of find those little gems and be able to say, hey, let's put in like $2,000 into marketing through a newsletter for the next five cycles and see what that does for. And if that doesn't work, let's try podcasts. Let's try this. And yeah, some of it might cost money, but then, you know, maybe next time you do it, you know exactly where to spend it. And it becomes a little bit more targeted in that way too. So there's just, my mind goes all over the place when I think about this, because I really the music side of the game for me, it's like I listen to people like Russ and whatever, and it's just like you hear him dropping like a song a week, song a day, like trying different things. That didn't work. Then he started, went back and took his album and chopped it up and then put it out as a separate album, and that ended up working. Like, so you really never know what people are gonna like attach themselves to, and you just kind of have to chop things up five different ways and see what actually works.
Yeah, Russ is a really good example of someone who's just like probably one of the like very few, not just musicians, but like musician educators, because he's always just like, he's an independent artist, yep, and he's sold out arenas. So it's like he has like, there's your credibility right there. It's like you're struggling putting your stuff out on SoundCloud and you're worried about somebody biting your style. I'm going to put something out here as often as I can, give feedback, see what works, because I want to give my fans the best of what they want from me, you know? And exactly. I think that, you know, like you see people taking that, like, just throw it at the wall and see what sticks approach. Someone else, Andrew Schultz, does that really well too.
Yeah.
Who just like was not afraid to just like, yeah, I'm going to put all my jokes on the internet. I don't give a fuck. Like, you know, just
yeah, see what exactly.
Works. And it has worked for him very well. So
yeah. And I think back to the Russ point, I really love the part that he is independent. He's just, you know, doing everything himself in terms of like the legwork, and you know, I mean, obviously as a team, but just like that portion of it. And then also going out of his way to say like, fuck the labels, they're fucking you over. Here's what you need to know. And he's showing his receipts, you know, he's going through his like things and showing the, how much money he's making off each song and the streaming, like the stuff that I feel like 10, 15 years ago that we all wanted to know, like the Lil Wayne's of the world. And like, how much money are these people making? This is crazy. They're all wearing a bunch of jewelry and they're driving these cars. Like nobody showed that kind of like transparency. And I feel like that took things to a different level where now it's like, you can't really hide anymore. It's like you're either showing that kind of stuff or you're not. It's like building in public, but this is like music in public almost. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah. Speaking of that, like, I was actually just listening to a podcast episode from Greg Eisenberg, where he was Dickie Bush and Nicholas Cole from Ship 30 for 30. And they're basically like, let's talk about how to create a $10 million business. And then I think at some point, I can't remember if it was Dickie or Nicholas, but they were just like, I would talk about this on your podcast, but I won't talk about this on Twitter because people get upset. Like when you start talking about like building a certain level of income, people who are like not yet at that income get really upset on Twitter or on LinkedIn. And there's like, they've said like they've tried to do it previously. Like they like will share their income, I guess. And people have gotten like really upset. And I just want to know like what you think about that concept of like sharing your income publicly, and like, do you think it's more helpful than it is harmful or like off-putting, you know?
And I'm going to speak for myself, and I think people, I'm going to go on just to say people are allowed to do whatever they want, whatever feels right to them in that moment. I think for me, money is not, I wouldn't put money at the top of like the success pedestal. And the reason why I say that is because I think there's a lot of shady ways to make money, but that doesn't make your journey a good one. I think the true success of it is the struggles and the learning process, just the same way you said about like the cameras you used the first time you made a film and all these other things. To me, that is a lot more important and there's a lot more depth to that than me taking a screenshot of my Stripe account and saying, look, a client just paid me $10,000. Okay, but like, that's great. But what is that interaction with that client like? Did that end good? Did it end well? Did they spend now $20,000, $30,000 the next month? Did they do this? That's the information that I feel like I feed off of to be like, oh, that's the meat of the whole thing. The money is just kind of more of a flex. And that flex to me, I've never been a money person from that perspective to be like, hey, check out like how much money. Like, I think people use that now. And I think it's, if I'm being very honest, and I might be a little bit off here, I think that's kind of fading away in the Twitter space a little bit more. I don't see it as often as I did even like a year ago or a year and a half ago, where people are posting their like Stripe things or whatever else it is. I think in the startup space, it's still a little bit happening, but that's also like a different type of business. But I think there is this like, there's this more of a journey-based feel rather than it is a, hey, you can make $10,000 by doing these three simple things. I think a lot of people have become immune to that bullshit at this point. They're just like, you know what? It's not three steps to make $10,000. Like, let's be fucking real. Like, it's never going to be three things you're going to have to check off the list and then $10,000 shows up in your bank account. Like, that's just not going to happen. Like, I don't care what kind of woo-woo shit you're doing, it's not gonna happen. You know what I mean? Like, and I think a lot of people, even when Twitter was kind of popping off with like Threads and all these other things, and people are like, let me show you you know, in 5 seconds how to make $1 million, and it's just like, I'm like, report, fuck you, like, I don't even, I'm not gonna read this, like, get the fuck out of here. You know what I mean? So to me, like, I never fell for that bullshit, because I think that's just a way for people to bring in, that's, it's like, I've posted this a bunch of times, and it's like, if you're think that there's a get rich quick scheme out there, you're the fucking idiot. Like, at the end of the day, like, that's my thing. It's like, no matter what you do, you have to have a level of value. You have to have a level of trust. You have to have a level of honesty. You have to have a level of knowledge and things that you can bring to the table to say, hey, this is what I bring to the table, and this is like what you're going to get out of it. Instead of me giving you a simple like template that's going to make you $10,000 tomorrow, it just doesn't work like that. That's not the world we live in. I wish we did, because then we'd all be fucking millionaires and, you know, sitting on a bunch of money, but it's just really not the deal. And so I never, for myself, I never cared about posting that kind of shit. I never cared about boasting about how much money, like, I ran a $1 million agency. Like, I never once took a screenshot of our Stripe account. Like, I don't care. Like, to me, I'd rather teach people, like, here's how you can be successful on Upwork by doing X, Y, and Z. This is how you raise your rates. This is how you do this. And you take that and you work it however it works for you, but at least you have the ingredient. It's like when you're cooking something, people could be like, hey, how did you make that chicken yesterday that you were eating? Well, here are the ingredients. I can kind of tell you what I did, but like, I don't have measurements. It's just like a feel. Like, you take some salt, you throw it on there, you throw this, you batter it, you do whatever you need to do, and that's it. You might want a little bit more butter. I might want a little bit less butter. Like, that's just all up to the person. And I think that's really the stuff that I get pulled into. That's the content that really feeds me, is the real shit that people say, man, I lost 5 million before I made 10. And this is how I lost the 5 instead of showing you how I made the 10. That's where I get fed. I'm like, yes, this is the shit I like reading.
Yeah. And I think I think the reason why people posting their income has been so effective is because, like, on some level, it's like a form of representation. It's like, you get to see what's possible, right? Like, and to Russ's credit, he doesn't just show, like, this is how much I made. He's like, this is what I did to get this money, and this is what you can do to
exactly do
that, right? But I think, like, for the people who, quote unquote, fell for these schemes, like, on some level, I feel like they were kind of preyed upon, because it's like, when you're struggling financially, you know what I'm saying? And you have someone that maybe on some level has posted enough on social media to get you to trust them and believe that, like, whatever they're doing is working, and you want that, you know, like, yeah, it's pretty fucked up when somebody's like, yeah, I can tell you how to get 10,000, but then they leave out the part that, like, somebody gave them 100K to start. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Exactly. Like, exactly.
Or, like, you know, they didn't have to worry about insurance or bills because they lived at home and their partner had health insurance. You know, it's like
circumstances, right?
Like, you know, we gotta be a little more honest about the circumstances that, like, allowed us to get to a certain level, right? It's a lot easier to save money when you don't have bills to pay. It's a lot easier to, like, maybe be a little more risky when you're still on your parents' health insurance. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
You know, like, it's different. Or when you are in a place where maybe you're in a walkable neighborhood and you don't have the expense of, like, a car, like, you know, like, your money can grow a lot further. Like, I just feel like that kind of nuance just leaves the platform. Or people don't tell you that, like, even though they made 1,000, they had to spend, like, 800 just to get the first 1,000. So it's just like you're not bringing that much home, actually. Like,
yeah, you know, yeah, you're making like 1,000, but yeah, you're making it's like the you know where I feel like Angela, that happens a lot too. It's like, and I never fell for it. And I was in the e-commerce space, and I still am, been for a long time. I never fell, and I know a lot of people that have made a great money running ads against their like products and different things. But I would have clients, I mean, some of the clients that we dealt with on the Shopify platform side of things that were making, I don't know, $5 to $10 million a year. The ones that were making $5 million a year were spending like $3 million on just ads on Facebook, right? Like just, you know what I mean? Like just, I mean, talking $10,000 a day, just like money going flying out. And they were happy to see a break-even point just to get the customer information. Like they were literally paying for that customer information to be able to email them and get them into the, like that return on investment takes a very, very long time. And to me, I always felt like, and I preached this from day one to all of my clients, and some of them took it, some of them didn't. And it's always like, become the hub of information, drive with content. If you add the layer of driving like Facebook ads or Instagram ads or whatever else it is and driving a little bit of that business, that's cool. But the minute that you start depending on that and that becomes your end all be all, the minute that you have to turn that off because that audience is not working anymore, you have nothing left here and you're just going to be dead in the water. You're going to be in credit card debt, your product, you're going to have a bunch of inventory sitting in your warehouse. Like, and I've seen it happen with my own two eyes. Like clients went from paying us $10,000 to $15,000 a month to being like, we're broke. We have no more money. We can't pay our invoice. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I just see like $2 million came in this year. Be like, yeah, but look at our expenses. They were like $2.5 million. I'm like, what the, and they had no, they had no foundational baseline to hold them, to give them some credibility, some authority. So people get caught up by this, like what you said earlier, like the shiny object syndrome. They got the flashing money signs that Facebook is constantly throwing at you. They like saw that. It's like walking into Vegas and you're just like flashing lights everywhere. Wow, this is amazing. But yeah, those people are just going to be there to take your money. You're going to walk into a casino and you know 99% of the time you're going to lose money and you're still going in there. That's what I feel like Facebook ads at one point was, and it is for some people who don't do it right. And again, there's always the other side. There's people who gamble in Vegas and they win a bunch of money and whatever else it is, and that's always going to be the case. But I just always told my clients, stand on what you know, which is content. Go drive that. Be organic as possible. If you have to trickle in some paid stuff, if you have to throw in a few things, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But don't let that be your like end all be all, because you're just going to be dead in the water.
Yeah. I also want to go back to what you said about like really niche, like podcast and like podcast newsletters being a really good space for like advertisers. But I also think like for, let's say like smaller creators like ourselves who maybe want to push like one thing, like we have mm-hmm. a course launch or we have a new product yeah. launch or if we have a new season, like that also being relatively affordable for us and probably a better return than like Facebook ads. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
And
exactly.
like that's something we're experimenting with this season, because I'm like, hold on, this is like affordable. I could get in front of like a couple hundred people, a couple thousand people for like, mm-hmm. you know, $1,000 ad budget, like this, hell yeah. You know what I'm saying? And yeah. I can spread it around yeah. like for different audiences. And like, this works. So like, yeah, I think like also people like, especially creators, like they may not think that way. Cause they're like, oh, this is my competition. Like, why would I pay another podcaster to advertise? And it's like, why not? Like if they have the audience right. that you want, like,
right.
And it's easy. Exactly. And like, you know, they're going to do a great job. Right. Because they have a good, you know, maybe you can develop a closer relationship with them than you can like, you know, and I hate to say it, like Justin Welch, who's like huge, who has hundreds of thousands of people following him and like has brand deals sold out for like 3 months. It's like, you know, I mean, like, are you really going to have a personal relationship with him? Not really, you know, like this is yeah, a transaction, yeah. you know, for a smaller creator, that's like everything, you know, especially if they've worked hard to build that audience like genuinely. So.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think that has a lot of weight to it, as well as like the person that you're following and the person that you're looking to work with in that capacity, whether it's a sponsorships or collaborations or whatever that might be. I think it comes down to what sort of responses are they getting to their content, or what drives you towards them? And then it's also this consistency basis, which over the year, I've fallen off on certain things. Like my podcast, I took like a 6-month hiatus. There was a lot of personal stuff. And I know there's certain angles to that. You just like, hey, you can still make it work. But listen, everyone's different. And I think for me, it's like, I would love to, my goal with this podcast has always been, and this is something I wanted to touch on with you too, is to get in the room with people and to be able to say like, hey, I want to have like a in-person podcast, because I think there's a different energy when you're talking versus like what we're doing right now. This is great and this works magnificently, but there's also this different approach to when you get in the room and you see that person, you're like, hey, that podcast is probably worth advertising on, even if it doesn't have this huge following or whatever else it is. But this person is making that effort to go meet with people, be in the same room. They're posting all the time. They're putting in the work. Yeah. In any case, like that to me is what I would invest my money into versus somebody that's just like, I don't know, just bullshitting, kind of like, here's the 3 ways of marketing your next product, blah, 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 blah. And then giving you like a 10-minute skit on that. And it's all scripted and all this other stuff. Like, to me, that doesn't jive with me. With some people, it might. But I'd rather be like, hey, Angela, like, let's do the next podcast in person. Like, how do we make this happen? Do I come over there? Do you come over here? Do we find a middle ground? Do we do this? Like, let's really bring these two things together. Because I guarantee you, the conversation, the spark, the hangout like would be very, very different, and that energy would transfer to whoever is watching it or listening to it in the long run as well. And I think like when I think about what I'm doing right now with everything, with my courses, with this, with that, it's like always trying to build a little bit more of that community, always bringing in a little bit more of that human aspect, even if it's a smaller group of people. Even if it's 1,000 people, but the fact that you know it goes deep and you know you can almost touch like 999 of those people every single time, that to me is more value than having 500,000 followers. Like, I could give 2 shits about that.
I just need to like clip this part of the podcast and like send it to all the people I'm trying to pitch to sponsor the podcast. Because like that was also like something we bet on. But like, yes, I'm going to do remote interviews for season 3 and season 4, and we've already recorded some. But it's just like an in-person show costs more to produce, right? Just because the sheer level of equipment and like coordinating and time that's involved, right?
Yep.
And like, this is also like, again, like when I went to a podcast festival, I recorded one in person, because it's like, how hard is it to get 2 people who don't live in the same city to get in the same room and record something? Like, that is actually very hard. It's hard even when we live in the same city. So it's just like, I feel like that should have a premium on it. And I can definitely tell, like, the rapport is just different, right? Like, we can have a little bit of banter before we hit record. But ultimately, like, once we're done, you know, maybe we talk a little bit more. But it's just different, you know? I can't offer you a bottle of water. I can't see how you're doing today. You know, it's very easy to put on like this.
That human touch.
Getting like the crazy. Human touch. Like nobody knows. Like, you
know? Yeah.
Like stuff like that. Like that in-person stuff, it's just different. It's intangible. And I, again, like you said, I do think there's been episodes where I think our best feedback has always come from episodes that we've done in person. Like that energy, that connection does, I think, come through the screen and come through the conversation a little bit more. So I don't know. Just makes sense.
It definitely does. It definitely does. So what else you got in the cooker other than the film and some of the podcast episodes and different things? Like, what else are you cooking up?
We have some YouTube videos. I'm trying something a little bit different. Doing some founder profiles, like some creative entrepreneur founder profiles, like things that I haven't seen yet. So those will be some solo videos that we do and publish in addition to the video podcast. But straight up, that's all I have capacity for right now outside of class.
Yeah. That's awesome. Do you have like do you have a little podcast studio where if you do in-person stuff, do you have it like a place you rent out over there by your house or something? Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So we've been using co-working spaces. Like there really aren't a lot of podcast studios that aren't audio, like they aren't meant for audio only, you know, like they, the rooms straight up just aren't big enough for me to even bring in one tripod and a camera, let alone two or three and an extra person.
Right.
So right now we've been using co-working spaces and that's worked out decently well. I mean, again, the end goal at some point, I would love to have my own space. So if you're like, hey, mm-hmm. I got some airplane miles, I'm trying to come to Durham, I'd be like, dude, yeah. come through, come to the studio. Like, I got you.
Hell
you know?
Yeah.
So like, we
yeah.
want to have that kind of boutique experience for our guests at some point, but you know, time.
That's
will,
awesome.
Will come. Yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. That would be great. And that's something that I, when I was kind of, I'm still in the process of like reworking this like space that I'm in right now, because I was like in the other room and I kind of wanted to change out of it. And I wanted to create more of like a studio type of space in here. And like even the desk that this is all like sitting on is like a workbench that goes in a garage that like folds into the wall so that I can have more space, and like getting like a little couch in here and like different things like that. So I'm still kind of in the process of doing that. But the vision has always been like cool lighting, a very relaxed type of place where I can have two microphones, bring people in, make it seem like that cozy thing that it is, not try to like make a small room look big, but more so be like, yeah, this is just where it happens. Like, it's my house, it's my garage, it's my whatever, and this is where it all happens. And I think that's where a lot of it is. But no, this has been really, really awesome, Angela, and I really appreciate you jumping on and chatting about all this. I love all the things you have going on. And and I do want to say before we jump off is, whenever you have that teaser and the film and all that stuff like ready, let me know in any way I can help, through my newsletter, through social media, whatever way I can help out with. Like, please let me know. And I would love to like amplify in any way that I possibly can.
I really appreciate that. That means a lot, really.
Yeah, absolutely. If I can support in any way, I know nowadays it's, you know, everything's getting more saturated. There's more people, there's this, there's that, people's attention span. So it's like the more cycles we can get it through. And hopefully, even if it's just one additional person that comes in and be like, that shit was cool. Or, hey, I want to like help sponsor that in some way or something. Like, please let me know. And I'd be happy to help out in any way that I can.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. And then last but not least, tell people where to follow you, where to look out for your podcast, your YouTube, all the fucking awesome things you're doing.
The easiest way is probably just to go to my website. It's angelahollowell.com. Yes, I have a very long name, but I'm sure he will spell it. Z will spell it for you. But it's just my name, angelahollowell.com. That has access to all the things I'm working on. So.
Beautiful, beautiful. Angela, thank you. Have a wonderful day. And I'm excited for this episode to come out.
Thank you. Thank you.